And now, it's time for our weekly news round, Lutheran Radio News with Paul Hill.
The first parish church doom painting made with traditional methods in more than half a millennium has gone on display. Before the Reformation, these brightly coloured depictions of Christ's judgment were common. They allowed illiterate worshippers to understand that sinning meant a journey to hell, but righteousness meant eternal life. During the 16th century, they were considered a bit too popish, and the vast majority were plastered over or destroyed. Now, at the rural St. Mary's Church in Woodham Ferrers near Chelmsford, Essex, a newly completed doom painting can be seen. It was based on the traces of the original that decorated the chancel arch, and following close examination of those doom paintings that remain. The name doom is derived from dom, an old English word for judgment. Using authentic pigments, gold leaf and brushes made from hog and squirrel hair, Steve Laws, the medieval art expert, painted a version of the original. Like most doom paintings, it's a representation of the last judgment at Christ's second coming, as described in Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. The painting depicts the righteous climbing from their graves to eternal life, and the unrighteous, including a clergyman and a king, departing to their eternal punishment. Other features include the apostles without Judas, a citadel representing heaven and the jaws of hell, Christ bleeding from the nails and with a gaping wound in his side, is flanked by his mother Mary and John the Baptist. Mr. Law said, "The church's original doom is thought to have been painted in the 1420s or 1430s and was plastered over during the Reformation. Victorians uncovered it in 1884, but since then it has suffered further and is now hard to discern. So it was a genuine thrill to be asked to recreate it using traditional techniques. A great deal of research had been done on the original with regard to the pigments used. And with the knowledge gained from examining the country's more complete paintings, I was able to interpret the Woodham Ferrers version. It is not as big as the original, but I hope it captures the colour and drama, and that it provides a sense of what worshippers would have once been looking at as they attended services. We are not used to our churches being decorated with bright coloured paintings, but it was once common." Nia McIntosh, a heritage consultant using money from the National Heritage Lottery Fund, has overseen a wide heritage hub project at St. Mary's. She said, "The original doom has been through a lot over the years. It was damaged in a storm in 1989 and has deteriorated further despite conservation interventions. It's now very hard to see, which was why we wanted to find out what it had looked like originally and create a new version. We were able to with money from the Friends of Friendless Churches. My desire was to bring the painting to life for our visitors and congregation, to create more of an immersive experience and transport people back to the medieval period." Steve is an expert in this area, and he examined the parts that remain of the original and studied documentary evidence from examination since it re-emerged in 1884. Tests were done on the remaining paint to establish exactly what pigments were used, and examination into extant dooms enabled an interpretation which is as close as we can get. I'm sure there hasn't been a doom painting using traditional techniques created for a parish church since the Reformation. St. Mary's has other medieval paintings and decorations, and we are currently hosting an exhibition and events to celebrate it. The exhibition, Doom and Discovery, Wall Paintings in the Medieval Church, runs until the middle of June. Other experts involved included Sarah Charles, a medieval book production expert, who handmade the original recipe pigments and the brushes. A Russian Orthodox priest who presided over the funeral of Alexei Navalny in March has been suspended from clerical duties for 3 years. The priest, Dmitry Safronov, is forbidden from giving blessings, wearing the frock and bearing the church's priestly cross until 2027, the Moscow Diocese of the Russian Orthodox Church said. Father Safronov was also moved to another church in Moscow to perform the duties of a psalm reader. At the end of the period of penance, based on feedback from the place of obedience, a decision will be made on the possibility of his further priestly service, the diocese said in its statement. The diocese did not give a reason for the punishment. On March the 26th, Father Savrinov officiated at a memorial service attended by thousands for Navalny, the former opposition leader who was President Vladimir Putin's fiercest critic inside Russia. Navalny died at the age of 47 in suspicious circumstances in an Arctic penal colony in February. Father Savrinov was also among a group of priests who had urged Russian prison authorities to return Navalny's body to his family. He had also reportedly refused to recite a prayer for Russia's victory in Ukraine, something other liberal priests have been expelled for. Navalny spoke at several times of his religious faith and one of his last legal battles from inside prison, and was for the right to have a Bible and the Book of Psalms in his cell. Most people are atheists. I myself was a militant atheist, but now I'm a believer, and this helped me because everything becomes easier, he said during a trial hearing in 2021. I ponder less, have fewer dilemmas. There is a book, the Bible, that clearly states what needs to be done in each situation. It's not always easy to follow, but generally speaking, I try. The Catholic Church is poised to open more schools as Gillian Keegan confirms plans to scrap a limit on faith admissions in England. The Education Secretary will launch a consultation this Wednesday on lifting a cap on faith-based admissions, which stops free schools and academies from selecting more than half of pupils on the grounds of religion. The Catholic Church has long opposed the cap, introduced in 2010, because it has argued that turning pupils away on the basis of their Catholic faith goes against canon law. Bishops have said they cannot sanction the creation of Catholic free schools while the cap is in place. If the cap is removed, oversubscribed faith-based free schools will be able to select up to 100% of their intake based on pupils' religious belief. Responding to the proposals, Ruth Kelly, the Vice President of the Catholic Union, said, "The Catholic Church is one of the oldest providers of education in this country, and Catholic schools consistently produce higher than average results. The fact that Catholic free schools were prevented from opening never made sense." Mrs. Keegan, who attended a Catholic school, said she had seen firsthand how values and standards in faith schools often give young people a brilliant start in life. She said, "Faith groups run some of the best schools in the country, including in some of the most disadvantaged areas, and it's absolutely right we support them to unleash that potential even further, including through the creation of the first ever faith academies for children with special educational needs. It is understood that existing faith-based free schools, which currently have to adhere to the 50% rule if oversubscribed, will be able to apply to have the cap lifted if the government's plans are given the green light. The Department for Education consultation will also explore how to improve provision for children with special educational needs and disabilities by opening special faith academies. It is currently not possible for special schools to open as academies and can be designated with faith status." The proposals were welcomed by the Church of England. Nigel Genders, the Chief Education of the C of E, said, "This broad package is good news because it will mean more people can benefit from the education provided by Church of England schools, which is so highly valued by parents and children and young people. By enabling Church of England special schools, we can serve the needs of more children in more communities, irrespective of their faith background." Mr. Gender said the plans will mean more people can benefit from the education provided by Church of England schools. Paul Whiteman, General Secretary of the NAHT School Leaders Union, said it was worried that removing the cap was an unnecessary and potentially retrograde step. He said, "We are concerned that there is a danger that such a move could inadvertently lead to a sense of selection through the back door and could potentially make it harder for some pupils to get a place at their local school." With their feathered helmets, ruffled collars and coloured puff sleeve uniforms, the Vatican Swiss Guards are often likened by curious visitors to medieval court jesters. But while they willingly pose for photographs, the watchmen are not there to entertain. Since the early 16th century, when Swiss mercenaries, revered for their bravery and loyalty, marched to Rome to serve Pope Julius II, the world's smallest army has been enlisted at the Vatican to protect the Pope his residence and the city's borders. Last week, journalists were given a rare glimpse of the guards' barracks in the eastern part of Vatican City and an insight into the background and daily lives of the troops as they rehearsed for the swearing-in of new recruits. Dressed in their traditional red, yellow and blue garb, complete with armour and halberds, the men practice an impeccably choreographed march in the barracks courtyard, each raising three fingers of their right hand to the sky to evoke the Holy Trinity while shouting the pontifical oath. Among the 34 who was pledged to sacrifice his life to defend the Pope at a ceremony last Monday is Renato Peter, 22, who was recruited from a village close to St. Gallo, one of several in Switzerland that has provided young men for the elite corps for centuries. He has dreamed of becoming a Swiss guard since first seeing one at a Wednesday morning papal service at St. Peter's Square at the age of 12. "Then in the afternoon we went to see the barracks," added Peter, who at the time was in Rome with his diocese. "I thought to myself, wow, what a cool job. I told my mum that one day I will be a Swiss guard. This dream never left me." The guards may look quaint, but the men behind the Renaissance-style uniforms, designed by Colonel Jules Repond in 1914, and not Michelangelo, as many believe, have undergone a competitive application process and rigorous training to get this far. Recruits must be male, Swiss, aged between 19 and 30, over 5 foot 8 inches tall, unmarried and devoutly Catholic, with an unblemished character. They must undergo Swiss military service and commit to serving the Pope for at least 2 years. They can get married after 5 years of service. The halberd is their traditional weapon, but the troops are trained to use small modern-day arms, including the more recently introduced stun guns. Since 1981, when a plainclothes Swiss guard rushed to the aid of a wounded Pope John Paul II after an assassination attempt on the pontiff, there has been a stronger emphasis on self-defense and anti-terrorism techniques. In 2018, Pope Francis boosted the army's number from 110 to 135. After a series of terrorist attacks in France and elsewhere in Europe, and in preparation of next year's Jubilee, when 35 million people are expected to visit the Vatican. "Like all armies, we have to be prepared to face all situations," said Corporal Elia Sinotti, a spokesman for the force. On top of the military training, the recruits are put through intense psychological tests to ensure they have the mental capacity to adapt to life as a Swiss guard. Many fail at that point, or perhaps they get hired and only last a few months when they realise the career is not for them, added Sinotti. Although the role of the Swiss Guard today is partly ceremonial and partly serving as a security service to the Pope, over history it has been engaged in ferocious battles. The swearing-in ceremony is held each year on 6th of May, which commemorates the anniversary of the army's darkest hour in 1527, when all but 42 of 189 guards died while defending Pope Clement VII during the sack of Rome by the mutinous troops of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. A vastly outnumbered army also prepared to die for the pontiff when Adolf Hitler's forces entered Rome during the Second World War, although in the end, the Germans did not attack the Vatican. Pope Francis refers to the guards as his messengers, because a big part of the job today includes providing comfort to the people who come to the Vatican seeking help, according to Sinotti. "They are desperate, as maybe they have lost their job or their homes, and the Vatican is their last hope," he added. "Some people want to end their lives, and we have to try and prevent them from doing this. These situations can be very tough, but we have to help to find solutions. Even just listening can help." Although the army remains exclusively for men, a new barracks is being planned with the possibility of accommodating women. "It is up to the Pope to decide whether women can join, and we will enact whatever he wants," said Sinotti. The guards work in 6-hour shifts, sometimes 12 on busy days. They earn about £1,200 a month, and on their time off are free to venture beyond the Vatican. They live together in shared dormitories. "Your life is pretty much 24 hours a day together," said Peter, "but there is good camaraderie, and we make really good friendships." He's feeling nervous about the swearing-in ceremony, especially as he has to play a small trumpet at the beginning, and so all eyes are on you. but he is ready to serve the Pope. This is the best part of the job. He is among the most important people in the world, and only 135 guys have the opportunity to do this. And finally, Pastor Jamie was reminiscing about his school days. He said, "My teacher accused me of not being very observant." Well, that was his or her opinion. He was going to join a debating society, but someone talked him out of it. When he was in his third year, his bicycle was smashed up. It was his own fault for handing out leaflets that said, "Bullying, let's break the cycle."
My name is Paul Hill. Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Lutheran Radio News will be back next Friday. Until then, every blessing to you and goodbye for now.